While the COVID-19 pandemic has been driving the world to distraction, a quiet pandemic of pesticides has been building steam that could prove to be far more threatening. This quiet pandemic leads us to ask, can what is deforming wildlife be deforming people?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1299th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Sasebo who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, on the previous edition of the Food Chain, that was number 1298, we talked with Mark Cook of Wolves of the Rockies up there in Stevensville, Montana, about the attempt to manage the predation of wolves, bears, and lions. Mark made note of the fact that to make it possible for farmers and ranchers to tolerate the predation of their domestic animals, they are paid up to 300% of the market value for each animal lost to the predators. Consequent to that conversation, I received a note from Judy Hoy, who is also a Food Chain guest from Stevensville, Montana, and that was back in Food Chain number 1263. Judy's note read, in part, when domestic animals die from being exposed to pesticides, the predators like wolves or grizzlies or coyotes eat them. Then the livestock owner reports that the wolves or grizzly killed the cow or sheep, so he or she can be paid for it. Livestock owners totally refuse to admit that their animals are being born with birth defects. The agriculture department told me that if the livestock have birth defects, it is up to the livestock owner to take care of it. How are they supposed to do that when it is raining and snowing pesticides on all the plants the livestock eat, resulting in the fetuses getting exposed and causing birth defects? I have no idea how they are supposed to take care of that. Do you? Judy's note and her years of wildlife research point to a quiet pandemic of pesticides that appears to be building throughout the world. This quiet pandemic leads us to ask, can what is deforming wildlife be deforming people? And so, let's welcome back Judy Hoy, who is the author of Changing Faces and Amazing Wildlife. Judy, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Hi, Michael, and everybody out there.
Good to have you back. It's been nearly a year since we last talked. And yet, here I am. This is the second week in the row that I'm hosting guests from Stevensville, Montana. Now, Judy, how many people live in Stevensville, Montana?
I don't know. And there's quite a few now. Several thousand now, I think.
Okay.
They're spread out all over the place, but they're there. Well, their mailing address is Stevensville, Montana, even though they live ways away from Stevensville in subdivisions.
Right. Well, let's see. You call yourself an independent scientific researcher. Does that mean you're not getting checks from Bayer AG?
I don't get checks from anyone. I necropsied over 600 animals, and I never got paid 1 cent.
Well, that's a very interesting story that I'm sure those people who did not listen to Food Chain number 1293 probably are going, now, what do you mean you necropsied so many wild animals? Why did you do that, and how did you do it, and where did you do it?
Well, my husband, Bob, was a game warden for Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and he's the one that first saw the birth defects on the animals that he picked up, and he reported it. And he's a biologist, but the biologist who worked as a biologist for Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks told him to to tell him when he got the next animal. At that time, it was on yearling whitetail deer males. They had no scrotum. Their testes were ectopic between the skin and the body wall. He got 8 in a row, and the 9th one was even crazier because it had one testes right in front of the other one, and they were laying kind of flat on the skin, and so they looked like a little train going up the belly of the deer. And when the actual biologist saw that, he kind of turned green. And so he took that deer and a normal deer and took it to the Fish and Game's wildlife laboratory where they looked at them.
Yeah, kind of did a biopsy then, right?
Well, they did a necropsy and of both of the deer, and they said that to the inexperienced observer, the one with the so two of their biologists that worked for them were the ones that brought the deer to them, and they still said in their report that to the inexperienced observer, the deer just looked malformed. That's what they said in one spot in their report. In another spot, they said the impact with the vehicle caused it. In another spot, they said it was an artifact of being dead. So they had three different reasons, all different, for why the deer was malformed. But it, to them, it was not malformed. So, and then the governor at that time was Governor Mark Roscoe. He, when I wrote to him, my mom wrote to him, but we did not have the same last name, so he didn't know we were related. And he wrote back to my own parents, telling my own parents that I didn't know what I was talking about, and that I was totally wrong, and here is the proof. And he sent them the report saying all those crazy things.
So you notice that things are really getting strange with respect to the reproductive organs of white-tailed deer. You submitted them to the Montana Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Not me, my husband did.
And the department did a necropsy, and they came up with these crazy reasons why these birth defects may have occurred, including getting hit by a car or being dead.
Right, but they said it wasn't a birth defect, of course.
Yeah. So, and you continued.
And then it went from there. That was the first one. And then they had my husband bring them. I think he took them 35, but they looked at only 28 or 29, depending on, they said two different numbers, so I'm not sure how many they looked at, but 6 of those had no scrotum at all, and they said it was because they were only 6 to 8 months old, and they would grow a scrotum when they became adults. And so I called him up and asked him what they meant by that. And that's what, and he just repeated that they would grow a scrotum. And I said, not on this planet.
So you're proving to be quite the troublemaker for the
yes.
established fish and game, and who are seeing these birth defects for themselves and denying the birth defects at the same time. You then wrote an article in 2002 for the Journal of Environmental Biology, and you point to neonicotinoids as being a possible cause. And that article was picked up, and with a lot more further research was conducted in South Dakota. Is that true?
Well, that's not quite right. The 2002 study that we did was on the reproductive malformations, and at that time I wasn't aware of how bad the imidacloprid was, which
and,
is what...
Yeah, and imidacloprid is a form of the neonicotinoids, correct?
It's one of them, and it's probably the worst one, and it's the most used insecticide in the world, which is not good,
okay.
since it kills everything. But the first study, in the 2002 study, we were still blaming fungicides because the only thing that I knew that had changed at that time, in 1994, the only thing that I had not knew that had happened in 1994 was that the potato fields to the west of us in Idaho, Washington, and Oregon had gotten potato blight, and they went from 10,000 pounds on 400,000 acres of one called chlorothalonil, the fungicide called chlorothalonil. They went from 10,000 pounds on 400,000 acres in 1993 and all the years before, and the years before, so they didn't use very much, to over 1.5 million pounds by 1996. And then in 1996, they there were two things. There was the chlorothalonil, became the most used fungicide, and it's deadly. And the imidacloprid became the most used insecticide, and it started being used in 1994. And the use of the chlorothalonil went up a huge amount in 1994. And Roundup, or glyphosate, which had already begun being used in 1974 and was used a little bit more every year, but wasn't used in huge, giant amounts until 1996. So the animals were already hammered by 1996, and then they made Roundup Ready crops and started using lots and lots of Roundup. And Roundup is a patented mineral chelator, and the birth defects, some of the birth defects were directly related to the lack of calcium and magnesium, and then the zinc is related to lack of zinc is related to the reproductive malformations.
Okay, so what we have here is a magnificent cocktail of fungicides, herbicides, and pesticides.
Insecticides,
which is a form of pesticide, of course.
Right, but all three of those are pesticides.
Right, that's correct. So you have a magnificent cocktail being applied to crops in Idaho, which is on the other side of the mountains from you.
And Washington, Oregon, and California, Idaho.
Everywhere.
Utah, you name it.
And we have wildlife showing up deformed. And so can what is deforming wildlife deform us? That is the question of the day with Judy Hoy and you on the Food Chain Radio program right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. And what appears to be eating what right now is an invisible, quiet pandemic of pesticides that appears to be deforming our wildlife. Now, Judy Hoy has been doing necropsies on wildlife that roadkill in Montana and noticing many, many, many forms of birth defects, including missing scrotums. What happens to the birth, to the reproductive organs of these wild animals? And so you did a interesting piece for, let's see, what was the journal called? Journal of Environmental Biology, and that was picked up by a South Dakota State wildlife ecologist named Jonathan Jenks, who did a controlled experiment with your postulate on white-tailed deer. Could you tell us about that experiment, Judy?
Right, except that the actual, they took white-tailed deer, and they had three pens of white-tailed deer, one for the control and one for a low level of imidacloprolide and another for a higher level. And they put the imidacloprolide in the water. The thing, Jonathan Jenks and Jonathan Lundgren and other people worked on that, but the lead author was Elise Berheim, and it was, and she's the one that actually apparently found our study and decided to see if I just mentioned that imidacloprolide might be contributing to the birth birth defects, and she found our study and decided to use that. I think it was, you know how they do a master's degree,
sure,
study, and then she had Jonathan Jenks and Jonathan Lundgren and a bunch of other people as co-authors who helped her with it. But she was the one that came up with the whole idea. And it turned out that the ones in the control pen had imidacloprolide in their spleen, because they killed all of the deer and tested their spleen at the end of the study. But the ones that had the highest levels of imidacloprolide in their spleen, the ones that died, or the fawns that had birth defects, these were female white-tailed deer, and they let them have fawns. And then they would check the look at the fawns to see if they had any birth defects, especially if they died. And then at the end of the study, like I said, they killed them all and checked their spleen and checked them for birth defects and everything else.
And they found?
Well, they found that the higher the level of imidacloprolide in the spleen, the ones that had the highest, the ones that died or had birth defects had the highest levels of imidacloprolide in their spleen. But what they also found was that the control animals had imidacloprolide in their spleen, and they didn't give them any.
So where did they get the imidacloprolide? Where did it come from if it wasn't in the experiment, and they were the control group? Where did the neonics come from?
Well, they were outside in a pen. It rains on them.
So it rains on us, too.
Oh, yeah, it rains on everything. It rains on all the grass that all of the ranchers' cattle eat, and so they also then, because they had high levels or somewhat high levels in the spleens of the control animals, they went out and checked the spleens of dead animals from road kills and from hunter killed animals, and it was something like 375 or something like that. And they some of those had higher levels than the ones they gave the most imidacloprid to in their study.
So what we're seeing here is that this neonicotinoid insecticide developed by Bayer AG, which is the same company that purchased Monsanto's glyphosate formulation called Roundup, we're seeing this insecticide in white-tailed wildlife, white-tailed deer in the wild, with higher levels of this neonicotinoid pesticide insecticide than your control group. So that would indicate that nature is being drenched in pesticides.
Correct. And then they went to Minnesota, I think. Minnesota. I think it was Minnesota.
That's okay. Someplace else.
They went and checked a whole lot of white-tailed deer in another state to the east, and it begins with an M. It's either Michigan or Minnesota. And I forgot to look that up. And I am old, and I keep forgetting things. And I'm also breathing the same pesticide, and it damages your brain.
Well, and, you know, Judy, that's the question of the day. We see this tremendous... Now, it's not just whitetail. They're finding this in the population of whitetail. But you bring up buffalo in your note to me.
And well, yes. The bison in Yellowstone Park... there's hardly any left with normal scrotum, they won't do anything except about it. They won't say anything about them being malformed. And anywhere there are bison, they're the same way. The bison in private herds, the bison at the bison range, the bison in South Dakota at Custer State Park, the bison at American Prairie. American Prairie was being quite helpful, and then all of a sudden they clammed up and wouldn't talk about.
So you're talking about things that nobody wants to hear about. But,
apparently.
But let's go. let me take you back to the bison. Would you describe for people what a normal bull bison scrotum would look like?
Well, a lot of people have seen what a bull, a regular beef bull or dairy cow bull scrotum looks like, but those who live in big cities probably haven't. The scrotum looks pretty much, it hangs down about two-thirds of the way to the hock, if it's normal, and there's a smaller area above the testes, so the testes are held well away from the body wall so that they don't get heat, so the sperm doesn't get heat damaged, and they are bilateral, which means that the testes are side by side. They aren't one in front of the other. Now, there are more with one in front of the other, or really weird looking, than there are with bilateral testes.
And you point to a video where people can actually see this, and it was taken in Yellowstone Park, in which a drunk tourist was chasing around a bull bison and vice versa. And you can actually look and see that the scrotum has disappeared.
Well, it's just not there. There is a little short bump where the testes are ectopic, and that makes a very little bump, the width of the testes. So see, the testes on a bison are pretty wide. So when you stick them under the skin, between the skin and the body wall, it makes a bump on the skin, right?
Right.
Anybody can understand that. That's pretty simple.
Even the city people.
Even city people. But the scrotum, most of them have better, they have cell phones and stuff. I don't have a cell phone thingy that I look at.
So
I look at my computer. But if I Google a bull from a long time ago, I mean, if you Google a beef bull, generally they have to measure a normal, they measure them. And if they're not the right length, they just send them to slaughter.
Okay, and we're talking, of course, about the scrotum of the bull.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, if a beef bull doesn't have a normal length scrotum or a normal looking scrotum, they just send them to slaughter or they castrate them. And so they don't keep them around. But with the bison, like in Yellowstone Park, all of those bison running around, those big bull bison running around eating all of the food that the cows and the calves need, most of them have scrotums that don't work because the sperm is heat damaged. And so if they breed a cow, she doesn't get pregnant. And so then she comes in heat a month later, and so the calf is late, so that's why there are little red calves running around in the fall when they shouldn't be. And they also get eaten by wolves worse if they're little teeny babies when in the fall, because when all of them have calves at the same time, then one or two get eaten, but the rest survive. But if one is born late, there's not a whole lot of others laying around, so it's the one that gets eaten. But I'm not saying that the wolves even bother to go eat. They don't always have to go kill
right.
anything, because a lot of the calves just die. And I would like to talk about, while we're on the subject of bovine type animals, weak calf syndrome began back in the 60s when there was a different set of really, really, really horrible pesticides being used. One was a herbicide, 2,4-5-T.
Agent Orange.
Well, yeah, they were using 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D, which was Agent Orange. And then they also were using one called Endrin, which was an insecticide. An insecticide like the imidacloprid, which they claimed wasn't supposed to hurt other, vertebrate animals. But it was killing everything. That combination was killing everything. So they banned the Endrin and the 2,4-5-T in 1985, and guess what? All the birth defects on the birds and the things like deer weren't even surviving. Like they couldn't find baby mule deer to save their life because they were all dying. And then as soon as they banned those two, there wasn't another the birth defect on the. I was only getting birth defects on birds because I wasn't taking care of the bigger animals back then in that time period.
So the birth defects disappeared.
So there were no birth defects from 1986 through 1995. I mean, through 1994.
Okay.
And then in 1995, birth defects began again, but they were a different type of birth defect. The birth defects with those other ones in before Endrin and 245T were banned, they were just horrible birth defects, and the animals just couldn't survive. They weren't just things like underbite and overbite and crooked legs and or missing toes or slightly malformed hearts, which caused them to all of a sudden die if they have a heart attack later. But things like all of the ones like that are happening now, those were not happening back then. It was different, and they were deadly, even more deadly than the birth defects are now. But except that for some things like insects, the imidacloprid just outright kills them, and it kills the spiders and all the other invertebrates. And guess what? Without invertebrates to eat, there's no vertebrates.
And without vertebrates to eat, there's no people.
Well, people are vertebrates.
There you go. You mean that what is having an impact on animals could be having an impact on people? Well, that is the question we have on the table today with Judy Hoy. She is the author of Changing Faces. And what is changing about faces? Pretty much everything. And Amazing Wildlife. Can what is deforming wildlife be deforming people? Judy has been looking carefully at animals for a long, long time and noticing severe birth defects that nobody seems willing to talk about. Why is that? We will be right back. Do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Like Rachel Carson's, Judy Hoy is pointing to things that people just don't want to see. And it's the deformities appearing in wildlife and the disappearance of a lot of wildlife, like the bee and insects. Judy, how many insects are disappearing from our world?
Well, insects of about 68% of the insects in the United States, that's between 65% and 68%, there's 65% to 68% less insects in the United States than there were 50 years ago, and most of those have disappeared in the last 20 years.
And, you know, you can really see that for those of us who have been around a little while. We used to take a drive in the country and come back and have to scrape insects off the windshield. Not so much anymore. So we wonder what happened to the insects. Why did they disappear? We wonder at the deformities in our wildlife. We wonder why the reproductive organs of the great bison are disappearing literally before our eyes. And Judy points to a pesticide that was developed by the Bayer AG company in the mid-1990s, it appeared. And we wonder, Bayer AG is providing these neonicotinoids, which are the most popular used insecticides. And Bayer AG also owns one of the most popular formulations of glyphosate, which is Roundup. So what happens when we mix glyphosate and neonicotinoids? We mix an insecticide with an herbicide. What happens, Judy?
Well, they work synergistically. In other words, that means they work together to damage the cells even more than either one alone. And when they are working together, they're 1,000 times more deadly than DDT ever was. And that's not me that said that. It was the scientists that said that.
So this stuff you see and you say and you have very good proof that this is having a tremendous impact on our wildlife. And where does it come from? I mean, wildlife are out there in nature eating natural things. So nobody's running around in the woods spraying pesticides, are they? Where is it coming from?
Well, it blows up off of the fields, in the dust off of the fields that are sprayed. With neonicotinoids, they put it in the soil, right on the seeds. And then they put the seeds in the soil. So the neonicotinoids, like imidacloprid, get right in the soil. And then when you spray the Roundup, it gets on the soil. And in the wintertime especially, that blows up into the snow and falls in the snow and the rain everywhere and on the mountaintops in the snow and the rain. And then that runs down in the rivers and the streams, and everything gets to drink it, and everything gets to And it's on all of the plants everywhere, no matter where you are, in the middle of the biggest desert or in the middle of the greatest forest.
It's everywhere.
Everywhere.
And it's a systemic pesticide. What do we mean when we call it a systemic pesticide?
Well, I think that means that it goes into the plant. And it goes into it goes up through the roots into the plant, and it goes throughout the plant in the leaves and everywhere, and that makes and then that kills anything that eats the plant.
So it's not
the animals.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily something that's on something. It's something that's in something.
Well, it's on it and in it both. I mean, it rains onto the soil, and so the plants uptake it, and wherever they are, and it rains on the plants. So if the bee comes along and eats, or a spider comes along and gets in the a drop of water from the rain that has the pest, the neonicotinoid in it, like imidacloprid especially, it kills the spider. It kills the bee. It makes bees get lost, too, so they can't find their way back to the hive, so they're just as dead as if it kills them outright. But I have found bees that were crawling around on the ground, tipping over, and they couldn't stand up. And there were lots of them doing that at the same time, right after a rainstorm. But before, there was one thing I wanted to talk about. We keep saying the wildlife.
Yeah.
Three calves out of 100 cows began dying of weak calf syndrome.
Now, Judy, what is weak calf syndrome?
Well, that's just what they named it, because the calves have all of the symptoms that the imidacloprid gave the deer in the deer study, which was that the deer had less energy. They laid around, especially the fawn, but even the does, they were correlated with less activity levels in both the adults and the fawns, and it also kills some of them. And that's why I said when the beef cattle die, that they get eaten. And sometimes even the best of investigators cannot tell that beef calf or cow didn't just die. I necropsied quite a lot of animals that suddenly had a blood vessel break in their thoracic cavity, and they drowned in their own blood, and it only took 2 minutes for them to die. And if a wolf came along and ate them, or a wolf pack, or a coyote, or a coyote pack, or a bear, or whatever, they would get the blame for killing that animal, because it just laid down and died because it drowned in its own blood.
So, Judy, these chemicals that have been developed by industry, and, you know, let's point a finger at Bayer AG, because they're right there. They're the ones who invented the neonicotinoids, as I understand it, and held them up as a much better alternative to the previous pesticides, less harmful, don't hurt vertebrates, we are told. But you're saying not true. Now, you're kind of like Rachel Carson's, you know, you're standing up and saying things, and you've been doing it for a long, long time.
Over 25 years.
25 years, and you hold these things up, and when people see what you have to say or listen to what you have to say, they kind of turn away and I don't want to hear this. And if you think about the tremendous food chain that's built up around these pesticides, there's, you know, if you follow the money, there's a lot of money involved in selling these things and distributing them and using them. They make farming easy. Is there any way to slow the use down or to stop it?
Well, there is organic farming, which is much better for the soil, much better for the crops you grow, and much better for all of the humans, animals, etc. that eat the crops. And organic farming works very well, and you do not have... Actually, imidacloprid was found not to be worth the money that it cost to buy it. It didn't make any doesn't make any better crops. it doesn't make better crops or more crops. But there is something I would, there, you keep, you were talking about little children. But before I mention the children, I want the 3 calves per 100 cows with weak calf syndrome. Weak calf syndrome is caused by mineral deficiency, and the weak calf syndrome calves, every weak calf syndrome calf that I ever necropsied or examined alive had an underbite. That was the same birth defect that all of the wildlife and calves and horses and horse foals, sheep, lambs, and goat kids, and llamas, and alpacas, and you name it, they all began having that underbite because of a mineral deficiency in the spring of 1995, and it got worse. But for some reason, the underbite has gotten better since 2014. The reproductive malformations have gotten way worse. The little males are being toast, and they're literally toast before they're conceived, after they're conceived in and growing up in the womb, and then after they're born. They just never quit getting hammered now since about 2014 or thereabouts, and I'm not sure why, because I can't figure out what new thing was done. The only thing I can find that was new about that time was that they started using Roundup mixed with 2,4-D. That was half Agent Orange plus Roundup or glyphosate. So it's glyphosate and 2,4-D is mixed together, and it's called Enlist, and they made Enlist ready crops. Now, you keep talking about little whether that harms children. Well, all you have to do is watch television for 5 minutes. They have a jillion little kids on St. Jude's Hospital commercials with all of the birth defects that we found, the really severe birth defects that we found on the animals with little kids. Lots of them have underbite, lots of them have overbite, but the dentists take care of that. It costs a fortune, but the dentists do take care of it. But the little kids didn't have underbite and overbite like that until after 1995. And there was an absolute epidemic of underbite throughout the world right after, between 1995 and 2001. After 2001, the underbite went down, and it went down in the wildlife and the domestic animals. But then the dentists tell me here that overbite is much more common on the little children, and that's underdeveloped lower jaw plus the chin. So they have a small chin and a short lower jaw, so they have overbite.
So
little kids are definitely being affected. Lots and lots of little kids are killed every year. They are there are lots of miscarriages. There are lots of Idaho has some of the highest miscarriage rates in the nation. That's where they use this. That's where they spray the stuff.
Now, the things you mention are all quantifiable. They're all kind of numbers-oriented observations. And yet, we hear nothing about them from the government or science or... there's Judy Hoy saying, look, why isn't anybody else holding these things up?
Oh, actually, there's lots of conservation organizations now that are working on these things. They go by letters, and
sure.
I can't think of all the. Any rate, there are a whole lot of really good ones, and they are working really hard on these things. But even they do not say very much or if anything, about the birth defects, and I don't understand that, because if you Google, everybody has Google. Everybody is always Googling everything. If you Google any animal's name and then underbite and then images, a whole lot of photos come up of, like, beef calves or calves of any kind, or goats. If you type in goats, a whole lot of goats come up with underbite. Everybody thinks they're cute, so they put them post. They think calves and goats with underbite are cute, and oh, they'll outgrow it when they grow up. Everybody keeps telling them. Well, they don't. They can't eat properly for the rest of their life.
And there it is, right in front of us.
Right in front of you.
As it has been for Judy Hoy there in Stevensville, Montana, who's been looking at the animals, the roadkill animals, animals that are killed on the highway, and she does a necropsy on them. And what is going on? We're dying, it seems. Will anybody stop it? I don't know. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Hitting What with Judy Hoy. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain? Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Judy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.